Welcome to the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Christian Research Institute President Hank Hanegraaff. Our mission at CRI is not only to equip you with Christian doctrine, apologetic accuracy, and discernment, but to help you become a faithful apprentice of Jesus Christ because life and truth matter. If you'd like to know more about CRI and the Bible Answer Man broadcast, call 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or go to our website at equip.org. That's equip.org. The following program was pre-recorded. And now, here's Hank Hanegraaff.
Thank you very much, Randy. Let's go right to the phone lines. Many of you hanging on. Stephen first, Dallas, Texas, listening on the web. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Hank. My question is a story that shows up in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Matthew says there's two men. Mark and Luke say there are one man, and it's that demoniac of Gadara.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you're right. And some critics have had, for some odd reason, the predilection to call this a contradiction. Obviously, however, wherever you have two people, there's always one person 100% of the time. So if Mark or Luke said that there was only one person present, there would be a contradiction, but the text does not say that. And this is, of course, one of those things by which we actually look as historians for credibility in the biblical text. We can safely conclude that far from being contradictory, what the gospel accounts do is present complementary accounts. And again, a consensus of credible scholarship considers a core set of facts presented by the gospel writers to be authentic and reliable for these very reasons. If everyone said exactly the same thing in exactly the same way, the first charge, of course, would be collusion.
I'm not charging collusion. To me, it looks like they're all the three. All three of them are the same story. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay. And then one of Matthew says it's the Gergesenes, and then Mark and Luke say the Gadarenes. But that's the same region, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's a town of the province of Gadara.
I saw this Dr. Constable. He said that the reason why Matthew uses two men is he's preaching to the Jewish audience.
No, I mean, again, the point is that, you know, whatever his motivation is, the fact of the matter is the gospel writers are giving their own account of a circumstance, and they're focusing on different aspects of the story, as you would suppose that they would. So if one of the gospel writers focuses on one demoniac and another on two demoniacs, there's no contradiction there whatsoever. Wherever there are two demoniacs, there's always one demoniac. If the gospel writer said there was only one and another gospel writer says there's two, now you have a contradiction, but that's not what the text says.
Well, good point.
So the point, again, is that historians look for a core that is reliable, and they look for such things as collusion. And again, if the gospel writers said exactly the same thing in exactly the same way, that's the obvious thing that you would conclude. Wow, there's some collusion going on. But that's not what's going on in the gospels. They give complementary details that are not contradictory and are far removed from the charge of collusion.
I'm not charging collusion.
No, I'm not saying you are. I'm just saying that this is what a lot of fundamentalists do. They come to the text and they're looking for these, you know, these aberrations in the text that they can charge the text with being contradictory. And so, again, it's because they want the gospel writers to have everything on Memorex, to say everything exactly in the same way. But what the gospel writers present is a reliable core that runs far away from the idea of collusion and runs to the corner of being a complementary set of information that's consistent, has a consistent historical core.
Good for me. I got no problem. I just wanted to ask your explanation of the variants of the stories from the gospel writers.
Yeah, because they're giving the story through their own perspective.
Gotcha.
You know, I mean, I could have, let's say I don't, but let's say I had two other people in studio with me right now,
right,
and I decided to talk about one of those people. Later on, someone could say, yeah, but I was looking through the window into your studio, and there were two extra people there with you. Well, the fact that I only talked about one of them would not be a contradiction to the fact that there were two present with me.
That guy doesn't want to split hairs, what it comes down to. I'm not trying to split hairs. I was just wondering if there was two different accounts, that if the explanation was Matthew's account was different than Mark's and Luke's. But
yeah, I mean, some people have said that, but there's too much in the story, I think, that precludes that notion. I mean, it's not an impossible conclusion to come to, but it's unlikely. It's far more likely that this is the same story seen through a different prism.
Good enough for me, Hank. God bless you. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, man. Back to the phone lines. I want to talk next to Joe in Kansas City, Kansas. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Hank. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I've learned a lot from your show and how to study the Bible, and I've taught my children, and now they're all adults, and they listen to you, too.
Oh, bless them. Thank you.
Yes. My question is, I was reading and meditating on Genesis 2:24. I wanted to know what you thought of the part of the verse that goes, "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife." And the reason I ask that is because my children are in their late 20s, early 30s, but they're still at home, and they do help me out. And everybody inside and outside of the church says, "Why are your children still at home? They should be out on their own." And when I look at children out on their own, they're usually in apartments or living together. Their philosophy is you get a boyfriend or a girlfriend, then you live together, and if you like each other, then you buy a house, and then you get married. And that just seems contradictory to Scripture. But even my children are wanting to leave home. And, you know, in the study notes in the NIV, it says that it's a protection that we're under the protective custody of our parents until marriage. So in today's world, what would you say to them?
Well, I mean, I think it's different in every circumstance. I have to confess, having 12 children, I still have adult children that are living at home and are not yet married, although I do have married children as well. But they're at home, and we're not looking to get rid of them anytime soon because they're a great help in terms of the overall structure of what's going on with so many kids and so many mouths to feed. And last night I came home and David had made dinner because my wife had to run errands and do other things in terms of, you know, kids' musicals and this and that and the other thing. And so, you know, thank goodness David was home to cook dinner. So instead of not having dinner or fending for ourselves, we had a wonderful meal together. So, you know, every circumstance is different. The longer we're together as a family, the more we love it. So, but again, every circumstance is different. But right now, having everybody together is an incredible blessing. We're just glad to have the whole clan together as long as possible.
Well, I can certainly understand that. My daughter is going overseas for missionary work for a little bit. I'm not anxious to see her go, but I'm anxious for her to come back home. So you don't think this is just something that's emotional or spiritual, but it could be physical, as long as they're helping out?
Well, yeah. I mean, again, every circumstance is different, but I think the real issue here is the wonderful relationship that I sense through your communication with your children, and you're enjoying that for now. Thank God for it.
I do, every day. I have a real quick question about the first question, the first person that was on. I'm an old earth believer, but it says in Genesis 1:1, that the earth was formless and empty, darkness was over the surface of the deep. And to me, that means the earth was like a rock or an asteroid floating around in the universe, and God took it and made what we know as the earth, which some people say is when it became the new earth. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I've written about this in the Creation Answer book. There are some people that believe that there's a gap between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. So there's a creation and recreation. I don't hold to that view. I think what we have here is Moses communicating in Genesis 1 that God is the creator of all things. And what he gives us here is not a chronology of creation, but a hierarchy of creation culminating in the crowning jewels of God's creation, humankind. Now, if you want to find out how old the universe is, I don't think you find the answer to that question in the book of Genesis, but rather you find the answer to that question in general revelation. I do, with you, however, hold to an old universe because I think that general revelation points to an old universe. But this is something that we as Christians can debate vigorously. We obviously don't have to divide over it. We'll be right back in just a few moments with more answers to your questions right here on the Bible Answer Man broadcast.
Every Bible Answer Man broadcast, such as the one you're listening to right now, is made possible through the financial support of friends like you. Each month, we depend entirely on God's provision through His people to bring you more of the broadcast, podcast, and other resources you rely on. If you want a sound proclamation and defense of the gospel of Jesus Christ to continue to be heard through the outreaches of the Christian Research Institute, become a member of CRI's support team today. Call 888-7000-CRI and stand with CRI daily in the battle for life and truth. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit our website at equip.org. We'll return shortly with more from Hank Hanegraaff. The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. A deeper understanding of the Bible's principles and truths will improve the spiritual, moral, and ethical problems facing our nation. Yet the obstacle isn't that the Bible doesn't speak to our greatest needs or answer our deepest questions. It's that the average person lacks the time and tools to extract the answers. That's why Hank Hanegraaff wrote the complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, revised and updated. This expanded edition addresses over 210 of the top questions he's received as host of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Hank has taken the complex and made it simple and memorable. Receive the revised and updated complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI. And make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or visit equip.org. That's equip.org. Has God spoken? Are the words of Scripture merely human in origin, or are they in fact the very words of God Himself? 3 years in the making and based on two decades of research and reflection, Hank Hanegraaff's monumental book, Has God Spoken?, answers what is surely the most important question facing our world. In Has God Spoken? Memorable Proofs of the Bible's Divine Inspiration, Hank counters the contentions of the Bible attackers and clearly shows that belief in the Holy Scriptures is not a guess or wishful thinking. It is the only logical conclusion after an honest examination of overwhelming evidence.
Order Has God Spoken from the Christian Research Institute by calling 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org, equip.org. Once again, here is Hank Hanegraaff.
Thank you very much, Randy. We'll go right back to our phone calls. Next up is David, listening in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi, David.
Hey, how you doing, Hank?
Well, thank you.
My question is about Genesis in chapter 1, specifically verses 3 and 14. In verse 3, which is the first day, it says that God said, "Let there be light," and it separated the light from the darkness. And then in verses 14, which is the fourth day, God said, "Let lights appear in the sky to separate the day and the night." So I guess my question is, what's the difference in the light?
Well, I don't think there's any difference in the light. Remember that what Moses is using is the construction of a week as a way of remembering that God has created all things. Now, there are young earth creationists that will suggest that God employed non-solar light to govern the days until he created the sun, moon, and stars on day four. But that's not what the biblical text says. The biblical text says, if you take it literally, as you should, there was evening and there was morning, indicating, of course, that the first 3 days of creation were normal solar days encompassing daylight and darkness. But again, this is not a means by which to give a person a chronology of creation. What Moses is seeking to do is chirologically, in other words, he's communicating God's purposes in creation. Kairos having to do with purpose as opposed to chronos, the time frame. So he's giving us a 7-day week by which we can remember that God created all things. And of course, on the seventh day, he rested, and we should as well.
Right. I guess what I'm just thinking is, like, if the first day he said, "Let there be light," you know, what light is that? Because in the fourth day, he said, you know, that let the lights appear.
Yeah.
Which was like the sun and the moon and the stars. So
right, but
the first
I think
day,
you're missing my point. What I'm suggesting is, yes, on the fourth day, we are to remember that God created the sun, the moon, and the stars. But on the first day, we are still remembering God's prowess in creation, separating light from dark. But we remember each one of these acts of God's creative prowess in the chronology of a 7-day work week. Again, it's not necessary for us to suppose that this is to give us a time frame. So God creates in one 24-hour day one thing and another 24-hour day another thing. It's a way of remembering using the 24 hours of a day as a grid by which we remember. So each day of the week, we remember God's creative prowess.
Okay. Yeah, I was just thinking, I was wondering, I mean, whether or not the two separate things, like he said, you know, he separated the light from the darkness, if that was just two, one and the same, light in the darkness, if that didn't have any other meaning besides, you know, our visual light or what we can see, you know, in the dark, or is it have any spiritual implication or?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, again, I think what's going on here is we can remember God's creative prowess, starting with his separation of light from dark, then separating the water above from the water below, then the dry land, then the sun, moon, and stars, and so forth. He gives us what happens on each day of creation, culminating in the crowning jewel of his creation, humankind. So again, this is a hierarchy of creation that we remember on each day of the week. So in other words, every day Moses is telling the people, you are to remember that it is God who created all things. But again, it's not a chronology. It's not meant to give us a time frame. It's meant to give us God's purposes in creation. And of course, the dominant argument that the Hebrew word yom, meaning day, used with a numeron always, always, always refers to a literal 24-hour solar day does not correspond to reality either. Because if you go to Hosea 6:2, there's a devastating counterexample. There, as in other passages like Zechariah 14, yom preceded by a numeral represents a period of time far longer than a single solar day. And then, of course, the unending nature of the seventh day constitutes a major exegetical problem for the 24-hour interpretation, because logically and literarily, the seventh day cannot simultaneously be unending and temporal. So the days of Genesis are rendered literal solar days, again, not to establish a chronology of creation, but to remember the purposes of God in creation.
Okay. Yeah, that's a lot better way of thinking it. I appreciate it.
God bless you. Back to the phone lines. We'll talk next to Rick in Alberta, Canada. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Hank. How are you doing, sir?
Good. How are you?
Good. I have a virtual truckload of stuff to throw at you. I wish we had an hour here. But there's things you don't talk about and things that throw me off big time. You believe in radiometric dating, obviously, right?
Well, sure.
Then how come, you know what the readings were after Mount St. Helens blew? You know what kind of readings they were getting like 3 months after Mount St. Helens erupted? Man-made gizmos don't answer these questions. I don't see the world as old. I see it destroyed.
Well, let's deal with radiometric dating. I think it's important to give you a little grid here. Nuclear radiation rate necessary to make sense of a 6,000-year-old universe, of course, would have been lethal to plant, animal, and human life. And I think it's also important that physicists have not simply presumed decay rates to be consistent. They have made a concerted effort to disprove radiometric dating by subjecting radioactive atoms to extreme temperatures, to extreme pressures, and to a variety of variations. And no change in the rate of decay of any geologically significant radioactive isotope has been discovered up until the present time.
Well, the argument is that we tend, like the global warmest theorists, they all lean on a certain model or science, and they will not move from their position, right? The assumption comes first, and then the science has to prove the assumption.
Well, and you know, that's the mistake I don't want you to make. I don't want you to take a presupposition and enforce that presupposition on the biblical text. I think it's important that you do two things properly. Number one, that you read the Bible for all it's worth, that you know the art and science of biblical interpretation. But secondly, it's important for you to do science accurately. If you don't, you can hardly be a testimony to the world. We're called to be students of general revelation just as we are students of special revelation. And that's why I gave a prologue to answering your question. Look, the age of the Earth, as determined through radiometric dating processes, corresponds to age parameters projected by astrological measurements like star life. And of course, star life also demonstrates that the age of the Earth is hundreds of times older than that presumed by young Earth creationists. Present projections regarding the age of the Earth, of course, in any case, are wholly insufficient for the evolution of even the most basic of all protein molecules. So, evolution is not helped at all by the notion of a universe as old as the universe is. You couldn't form a protein molecule in the time necessary. So this doesn't help the evolutionary paradigm, but it doesn't help the creationist position not to read general revelation correctly or to raise red herrings or conundrums that have no basis in reality. I want to go back to the phone lines. And we'll talk next to Amanda, listening in Columbia, Illinois, on Bot Radio. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. I just had a question. My church has been going through the Gospel of Mark, and I was talking about it with one of my friends. And one of the stories we went through was when Jesus healed Jairus' daughter in Mark 5:22. And the friend I was talking to was saying that, well, he's not a believer, so he was saying that, I can see that this is like a fictional story by the fact that Jairus' name means he will awaken, which I guess something he was reading on a atheist website was saying that was what Jairus' name meant, and that he will awaken is the meaning, and that it signals the fictitious nature of the story. And, I mean, not that I had the most scholarly approach to it, but when I looked up the name of Jairus online, it was he is enlightened or God enlightens. So I didn't know if, like, that was even true and if this was a common argument, and I guess just generally what your input was.
Yeah, well, first of all, I like what you did. You found another definition for the name Jairus. And that would be the first comment that I would have made if you hadn't mentioned that in the prologue to the question. The meanings of names are various. They're not always the same. That's number one. Number two, and I think more importantly, is the fact that if you read Mark chapter 5, particularly starting at verse 21 through the end of the chapter, this has all the markings of a historical narrative. I don't think anyone that reads this text in an open-minded fashion would think that this is just a story. No, all the details and the descriptions demonstrate this to be a historical narrative. So the question that follows is, does this historical narrative correspond to reality? And the answer is absolutely. This is a core set of reliable facts that historians look on, and they see that there is no collusion, and there's obviously complementary details, again, that make this story historically reliable. A lot of other things that could be pointed out. I've done that in my book, Has God Spoken? Out of time. See you next time with more.
Thank you for joining us today. Our mission at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith, answer Bible questions, and encourage Christians to watch their life and doctrine closely. To find resources to help equip you, go to equip.org. That's equip.org. Or call us at 888-7000-CRI. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is supported by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. Anyone who's been paying attention knows there's a war going on, not just on traditional morality, civility, and decency, but even more fundamentally on historic notions of truth. And the enemy isn't just the onslaught of fake news facilitated by a post-truth culture and turbocharged by growing legions of ideological spin doctors. No, the real enemies of truth range from postmodernist convictions that there is no objective truth to militant scientism that claims that only science can determine truth, and religion is little more than primitive superstitions. But CRI support team members are not waving a white flag of surrender. They're holding the fort by undergirding every one of Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping and life-changing outreaches 24/7. To learn how you can make a difference and enjoy all the benefits of support team membership, simply visit equip.org.